tonight. It's my pleasure to welcome back C.T. Big Goose, author of We Shout Into Silence, this book here. His talk tonight is entitled When the White Man Smiles. He greatly impressed us all, the staff, and many of our Many Rivers friends in his last appearance, and so we were delighted that he agreed to return tonight. Thank you so much for coming back.
We've been advertising this book for 20 years now, 21 years. But I never told. It just occurred to me today, yesterday, that I never told anybody about what it's really about. It's the book itself is about revenge on the Indians should take against the police officers who are killing our Indian people. That's been going on for years. But my story began in Nevada City. I was living in Nevada City, and I had just gotten out of jail from fighting the police up there. A little Indian girl was her husband came up to our house. Him and my brother were drinking together. And she came up later and asked him for some money for the kids. He took the welfare money and the food stamps. And he walked up to me. She was standing behind him. He walked right up to me. And he hit her. He's 6'2", 220 pounds. And he hit her. And I had a rifle sitting by my desk. And I grabbed it and I hit it. Hit him, I broke his nose. And I told my brother he was too easy. Go see, for a biker, he should have been more of a fighter. So I told my brother to go see what was happening with him. My brother came back pretty soon. He was all beat up, bleeding and everything out. He said, there's a bunch of them down there. I said, well, let's go down there and see them. But they weren't bikers like the outlaw gangs, you know, like the Hells Angels, or they were pretenders. There were husbands and stuff like that to go out on the weekend, but they took over the bar down and they were beating people up. But they come back to our house and they start throwing things, and I grabbed a rifle and start shooting at them. They call that the big last great Grass Valley shootout. They ran back down there and very soon we went back down to see where they went. And there's a little bar right down the street. We went down there and they had called the police on us because we beat them up. They called the police. The police were coming. They tried to arrest us. And I said, you're not gonna arrest me today. He took up with us. And I told him what happened with his wife. And automatically the cop turned into a cowboy Indian thing. And it was a prejudicial racial thing. And I told him, he reached for his pistol and told him, you better be fast enough to kill both of us. Or you better be smart enough to come kill him. Because we're not going to mess with you. And he said, nobody listens to me. He ran down and he got went and got his gang. And they came up and we fought him down there. We came out of the house and fought them. But see, no one believed us. This is how the Indians get killed. They get in fights like this, and it's all of the cops always take the side of the child beater, the woman beater, the drug dealers that we fight. In our class then, in our type, our type of people. Which was when we were drinking then too, so we were on drugs and, you know, everything. But they arrested us on seven counts of assault on police officer, which is a life sentence. Now we got out of that, and that's the last time I drank. I sobered up after that because I finally got tired of going to jail. My cycle was in always working, blowing the money, and then going to jail. It was over and over for a long time. And I was 42 then, still fighting with the kids. You know. But when we got out, whenever they sent us down to Vacaville for a mental evaluation, and the lead psychiatrist there, her name is Englander. She was head of the NOW, NOW, women's organization. And I told her what happened. As it escalated through there, the cops didn't think nothing. The cops thought nothing about anything except getting the damn inmates. That's on their reports and everything. And that's how that happened. But I just happened to have a... I also just happened to have a... It's how funny how these occurrences happen, you know, in our lives, where you think it's all over and some catalyst happens. And I was in service with one of the higher patrolmen. He was in my squad. And he told them, you better... Stop him and my brother now, because these guys, it's going to be all over, because they're rangers. You never see what rangers can do, airborne rangers. And the cops, the city cops, they got macho then. Well, we could take them, you know, but we said they couldn't if we could get the weapons. That'd be it. But just before I got sentenced, the cop, the higher patrol was kind enough to go check on what happened, because the guys were bikers. He found out how they were phonies, and that he went and talked to the lady that got hit, the guy's wife, and he told her, just return him, just said, well, it's too late, we're going to send him up alive. He said, no, you're not. And they but he said it was too late to get that. He said, it's too late to get this guy that we fought, the guy that hit the woman. But he's what we can do is put out on the highway that he's a snitch. So you know, in a way that justice prevailed. And I got out of that, and I was sitting out wondering what to do with my life, because I had never worked in my life. I'd always been drunk and drinking and stealing and working out. That Indians do, because you can't get a job. But my nephew came up from Oklahoma, and he told me that the cops killed my nephew. And I'm the oldest. I'm the oldest in my tribe. I'm the oldest. I'm the head of a clan. I have two clans, my mother's and the Bigfoot side. I'm the head of two clans. And my clan of fame is keeping them safe within their environment. That they would, I made sure that no one ever approach them or hurt them. So they go to school, go to college, and a lot of them have. And I knew I had to do something about that, so I walked down the road a little while. I come back up there, and it just occurred to me that I had an English teacher that told me that the writing was, you know, more powerful than sword and all that kind of stuff. So I went down to Salvation Army, and I got a little big old typewriter, you know. And I cut loose. I wrote this book in 2 months. But I had some good friends. They were best-selling authors themselves, but they wanted to help me get it. And we got it out, But it wasn't about what happened with Dean, with my nephew Dean. He was Dean was a harmless drunk. He'd come to the end of his road at 30. He was 34. but he was going to die. There was no, he was either going to get the grandma seizures or get the pneumonia from sniffing. He sniffed that spray paint. These guys do down there. And he was walking down the street, and this is where it got me. When the cops kill somebody, they usually get a call, like the guy here they killed here. They'll get a call that this guy is violent, and well, they can come over and shoot him if they want to, if they get that call. But they didn't get the call for Dean, so it's murder. And that's why. And you can't fake it. You can't put that call in afterwards, because it's all a daily task for the cops to keep track of that stuff. And Dean, I got mad because Dean, I held him when he was a baby, and he was loved. That's the one thing we can't say in our tribe, is that we weren't loved. We can't use that as an excuse because of whatever crime we commit. We can't say, well, my mother didn't love me, or any of that kind of stuff. Well, we were. There's no doubt in my mind. But they stopped him and this guy named Benny No Ear. They were just walking down the street. They might have been going to get in trouble, so if they hadn't gotten there yet, they were still sober. And they pulled him over. They stopped him, pulled him over, and they told Benny to go. Benny walked off. And they thought there were no witnesses, but because when something like that happens, nobody wants to say anything in Oklahoma, because they'll be next. You know, you just don't snitch on somebody. But the guy that was right there in his front yard, he watched the whole thing. And the cops said, the first one shot him in the head. Shot him in the head and he fell down. And he's laughing about it. He picked him up, set him up. And they all stand back and empty their pistols into his head. They didn't shoot him anywhere else but in the head. He didn't have any face. And he had no face, no back of his head. They just bone fragments sticking up. And this is what they try to cover up. They would not let anybody see the body, not even his family. And they put him in a casket and they welded it shut after the autopsy. They welded the cops, police welded it shut. And this is what it wasn't that made me mad. Because we all expected to it's probably the best way to die, to be shot, because you're gonna die a terrible death if you die from alcoholism or you go crazy from the paint, spray paint. And they're all bad deaths, long lasting deaths. I mean, if you make it through, you're not never gonna be right. But what made me mad was that they had the audacity to do this over and over and over again. The same way these white cops, and they're trying to, I don't know what kind of message they're trying to give us. Nobody's scared of them. Nobody's afraid of them. No Indian I know is afraid of them. That we're not afraid of them. Because we know we scared the hell out of them when we start coming back from Vietnam. And this is why I wrote the book. I didn't know what to write, because I didn't know Dean's whole life story. It was probably just one day drinking it after another, like my life had been. But I was hurting guys after these things happened. Talk about what they wanted to do. They all get together and shoot it out. So that's why I wrote this book in that way. And I called it "When a White Man Smiles" because it was a reflection of the frontier days when the Indians fought for 60 years. It's the longest America ever fought anybody. They fought it for 60 years. Couldn't bring them in. So they lied to them. They lied to them, and I promised them land, food, the rations, places to stay, houses if they want to. That was when I put down their weapons. That's when the white man got bad, got tough. He was tough then because he could shoot you and get away with it. And the saying developed within the tribes when a white man, when they do, he's smiling. So they got that old saying, when a white man smiles, get away from him. That's why I put that in a book, because our lives down there is violent. I can go right, take you down right now and show you the violence that's going on right here, right now. What exactly is that? But I still miss Dean. I never even knew him. When I quit drinking, I didn't know what to think or feel or how to act or anything. That's my problem now, is social things. And meeting people and talking to them. But the money we make off this book, I wanted them to see the real life. In the book, I want people to see the real life actions of what it would take to. And the Indians don't have anything to lose. There's nothing to lose at all to do these things all over the country. There's Oklahoma. There's 9 million. 9 million. And we went down there and tried to get a voting block, a voting block that'll control the swing vote. To get them to come out of the bushes down there and vote. Out here, no one listens. These Californians don't care, as far as I'm concerned. But that's if you don't see the reality of it, then it's just gonna go on. If the public don't see the reality of it, then it's gonna keep going on. And it's because I know we can't whip them, but that's just a silly thought in my head that there's nothing to lose. There's nothing to lose. There's no other way but to describe it and hope it catches on and somebody says, well, if this is really happening, let's change it. And that's what we're trying to do now. And that's what we did this because we started a non-profit. We want other Indians to ride instead of getting a gun, getting a rifle, getting to join Al-Qaeda and all that kind of stuff. The nationalists, getting other countries to arm us. And it'd be a hell of a fight in Montana and, you know, it'd be the Indian Wars all over again. So that's what we're trying to stop it. We want to have enough money to hopefully to start our own educations, to get our own educations, collegiate place to get our own doctorates and master's degrees and stuff like that, because they can't make it. They can't make it in regular schools. Because there's not enough money for them to do it, to follow through on it. They give you just enough money to pay your tuition for one thing, but you don't have a car, you have no social life, so it's easy to just go get drunk with the rest of your money. And we've seen that over and over. But that's what we're doing with any money we make out of this book is to help our Indian people write and help our artists. We have our art is being sold. Indian art is being sold at $1 billion a year, and no Indian is benefiting from it. The artwork on a reservation is sold like $5 for a silver band, he get and the little man, he'll get $200-$300 for it. And we don't have that kind of marketing skills or anything like that, but we do. We are producing writers who learn how to write books. I learned how to write just by looking at it, reading a book and looking at it and see how it's made up, and then just putting my words in there and finding similarities where I could fill in what I wrote. So at first I was hoping I knew what the heck I was doing, but I had some good people come straighten the book up and take all the cuss words out and all the bad things, you know, to come down to this point of view. I don't know if any of you read it or not, but the reason I'm having so much trouble with it is because the biggest thing about it is they don't like the word when a white man smiles. That's why they change it to that other one. And it's not a bad thing. It's history. It's our history, not just Indian history or white history. It's everybody's history. It needs to be told. So it won't happen again. It won't. You know.
Are these reservation towns or are these?
Yeah, they're not reservation towns. They're in Oklahoma. They have the biggest troubles they have with Indians are the reservations are nearby, mm-hmm. and you got to go in town to deal.
Right, to buy things.
To buy things. And
so it's in town that you're having the problem.
Yeah. And whenever you go up there alone, you're in big trouble. Even down in the country, when I was growing up, we never walked down the highway. But there were some people out there running them down. They killed 30, 40 of them. No one never caught anybody. We used the three rivers by a reservation. We used it. Walk close town. You know, we never found a hitchhike down the highway. You'd be killed. They'll shoot you.
Well, I used to live in Carson City, and I ran into some of that.
Yeah, I
didn't realize how real it was until then.
Yeah, my sister-in-law, her 18-year-old son passed out by a bridge over there by Gardnerville, and these teenagers drove up and set him up and used him as a target and killed him. But they arrested him. This was in 1990. Mm-hmm. And they arrested these guys. First time anybody ever been arrested for killing an Indian. And they got 10 years, I think. But the thing about it is the Indians are organizing these prisons. They can get you. Now they'll get you. It's like these white gangs or any other gang in there. And there's a bunch of them in there. And they're all different tribes, but they stick together. In Oklahoma, they run the jails down there. So if you do something in there, they'll get you in there. Some of them.
Now, let me read the chapter in the book.
She's worried about me.
Keep you out of trouble.
She's worried about me saying all the rest of you. I don't mean to say bad things. I'm just saying that this is how the book turned out. I mean, but it is American history. That's the one thing. I'm not saying it because it's an Indian thing. You know, I'm saying it because it is a part of our history. And if we get it right, it won't have to happen again. And it hasn't happened since that book came out. In 21 years, there's been no more killings there or up north. Because there were more going on up in St. Paul Twin Cities up there?
Minneapolis,
St. Paul. Those cops just there. It is a way of life for them to walk up, nobody looking to shoot them. You know, beat them to death with batons. Yeah. I'm not trying to scare anybody, but that's how I had to live in my life. I got beat up a lot of times with batons.
So that stopped since you read the book?
Yeah, it's been killing me. And I hope it's not because of that book. And I want other Indians to write it too.
So what is your greatest concern today?
My greatest concern is we're losing a lot of our people back to alcohol and drugs. We were finally making progress and going to school and, you know, doing all the good things, working in my tribe. There's one guy, my cousin, he went to school, he became a doctor. He worked his tail off going through. I helped him out there. Everybody helped him when he was good. But he didn't need anybody. He went through. He got up every day and studied everything. He went through. He graduated last year. We have another doctor. We only have two writers in it. Like me and he's dead now. But there's two of them. But my wish and my hope is that we get it where we can do our own education. Get our own education. Become lawyers. Mm-hmm. Become lawyers that are going to help the people, mm-hmm. not some mountain Indian firm, you know, that'll take up the money thing and they got to work for them. I don't want to see that. I want to see our own hospital. I want to see our own healing ways. We have healing ways that go back. I don't know how many thousands of years. It's still here, and we don't do it. We don't do it because of the non-belief of the other people.
I would almost bet that there's more appreciation for those healing ways in mm-hmm. the white world mm-hmm. than there is in your own.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because there's a lot of interest in it.
Well, I found that out because as a spiritual leader, I'm a spiritual leader of my tribe. I've come to see that it's a matter of choice among the non-Indians who build sweat lodges, and they get their own they get their token Indian, there's two ways to be a medicine man. One is to heal, the other is to change things. You can't do those things. You don't have any business in that lodge. Now, we've been saying that for years. Now they're dying in these lodges. They're without the Indian in there, they're getting kidney diseases. They're getting liver. All these things, flat dying, heart attacks.
Because why do they do that? Because they are not trained.
Yeah.
For water.
And they just get it in their heads they can do it. And there's more to it than that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Have you heard of Friendship House in San Francisco? Mm-hmm. So I have a close person close to me who went through that program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a concern about, you know, the alcoholism. And mm-hmm. there are some, that an example is about 95%. Native American.
Oh yeah,
and you know, there's like some people are trying to incorporate traditional healing along with other things, and that's a anyway. I just wondered.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it seems like a good.
They incorporate it along with AA. I don't believe in AA. I'm a drug and alcohol counselor. I don't believe in that because you didn't get drunk in the. Hey, Bill, you got drunk on the street. You got drunk at home. And you can't go. If you can't grasp that idea, then you're gonna be drunk all the time. Because I believe that Indians should cure themselves. And then teach if white people come along, want to learn and make them. In my tribe. My Pampa songs were really desirable in the 50s and 60s, even now. And we made songs. People would come and camp out, and they'd make a song for them. But before they got on that drum, they made them wait. Sometimes 8 years, 9 years, until they, and then they'd get up there and teach them that song. And a white man won't go through that.
Right, this whole culture is like
he will not go through that because he knows it all.
And, I understand.
And now they're going around killing each other. That had to come. See, that had to come. It is a good way of life. It works. If you know how to work it. And you can teach it to others to where it'll work. It's not a one medicine man thing. Everyone has the ability to heal. Because I was taught that we're all self-contained. And when nothing else works, you cure yourself. See, that's what I was taught. I don't care if it's bullets or diseases or anything. And I've seen people down in Lawton, down in the Indian Hospital in Lawton, come out of those TB wards. And they say, I don't want this shit anymore. Just get up and walk out of there and they're cured. And they never knew how they did that. So they'll send a team of doctors down there. No, she didn't have it in the first place. These damn Indians can't do that. So it's just even around here, I've had more trouble just trying to have us just go to a sweat. Because I went to one, that guy said, I guess our first day he told her, you punk, I hate soon. What? Did you get a chance to say, yeah. But it does work, and I believe that it should be taught. It should be taught in college. As a way of healing, an alternate. But I don't believe they'll let you because if people start getting healed, there's no money in it. So we have that trouble. I have that trouble. Can you bounce that question?
Yes, state senator here in California, her husband fills a lot of casinos for the Indians, mm-hmm. and she goes around telling everyone to approve them because all the Indians benefit greatly from these casinos. What is your opinion of that?
I don't believe in that. I don't believe that. I believe that they're letting them go just like everything they've ever given us. And we make it grow, we make it prosper, and take it back. And it's going to be the same way with these casinos, especially if this recession gets in work. Schwarzenegger or somebody like him, it's not going to bother them a bit. They're foreigners. He don't care about Indians. That's where it's getting to. Anyway. But the casinos, nobody I know ever benefits from it, except it's just like the money we get from the government, the funding we get from the government, my tribe especially. They give them $6 million a year. There's 600 people down there, $6 million. They could have all the money they want, but the only ones that get it are the tribal council and their friends. It doesn't get past that. It doesn't get past that. We've had a casino. We were the first tribe to ever get a bingo. No one ever got any money out of it except them. And we were the first ones to have a casino in America. And it's still going on. And nobody I know, I've never seen any pay. It's 30 years and I haven't seen a payment out of it yet. And it makes at least $1 million a month.
I wonder if you could write a book about that.
I am. I got one in progress now. It's called the People in Cedar Valley. People in Cedar Valley. It's about the Indian medicine ways that we had before Europeans came. That everybody wonders what happened to the Anasazi. Everybody wonders what happened to the Hohokams and all that. Mayans. Well, they made in their minds. No, I've never heard any books on it at all. Anything about it. Just being progressive or no any way to be anything but savages. But those people knew how to tell time. There's a clock. It's upon a Rocky Mountains, they call it a wheel, but it's a clock and a direction finder. And they knew that the Europeans were coming in 1100 before they would show up. They knew that. And they decided to leave. And where they went, I don't know. My guess is they went in the cedar boughs, because we use cedar as a medicine. And I believe that they left us here to take care of, to stop this atomic bomb. That's the biggest threat to life, these bombs. I mean, if these Indians don't come up with enough medicine to stop that, they're going to take us all back to the cedar boughs and let them blow this house up.
So, peacemakers. So, was that the Toltec teachings?
That's some of the Toltec, and some of the Mayans. It's the ones in Peru. What are they called? Incas.
Yeah,
the Incas and their enemies. Mm-hmm. But they all had a common thread of knowledge.
Yeah.
And when that time come, they didn't say walk out to the body, there's a white man coming. They use it as a, they said there's a force of nature coming. And a destructive force of nature, like a blizzard, and they're going to tear the land up. They're going to poison everything, and they're going to make a big fire. They didn't know how to describe atom bomb blast, so they said there'd be road. If we can't stop it, then that's it.
So you already did.
Yeah,
it's done.
Mm-hmm.
It's done.
So there's more to it than that. I'm trying to, the problem with me is I am not educated. See, since I've been writing, I've been reading. Before that, I drank. I got drunk and shot food all day. But I'm teaching myself. Teaching myself how to use my language. Interpret my own language into words.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was young, we had sun dancers that fought the Sioux, fought the Crows, fought everywhere. Our last of our sun dancers. And they told us stories. And they were happy as heck, 130 years old, 140 years old. And they told us stories about what's here and what's now, and that there are things here that we're not the only attempt at life. We're the only ones making a journey. We're the only ones that had enough sense to make a journey and accommodate ourselves by getting things to keep us going. There are things walking around right now that we don't see, like the Sasquatch, like the dragons, like all them. Them things were real. They just couldn't make it in this life. They didn't have anything to do with no explosion. They just couldn't do it. But I heard those stories when I was young, see? And I learned from them. I'd go back home and talk to my people, and they don't understand it. Because it's turning into a what do you call that word?
Slang
talk, like on the street. Pidgin English, pidgin punk.
But weren't you taught by the old ones, though?
Yeah.
That
mm-hmm.
language.
Mm-hmm.
And the newer language wasn't the same.
No. And we also, when we went to war, we were already settled on the plains, like the Ponkers. We had villages where we built on the plains up by the Niobrara River, Canada. I mean, Nebraska. And we grew wheat and everything out there. This is what American farmers did. And they they ran the Sioux and the Sacramento, Shawnees, Pawnees, the Ricolas. They ran in out of the east. They're woodland Indians. They knew how to kill buffalo because they had woodland buffalo. But they came on the plains, and the Ponkas taught them about the pipe. See, but we were already broken up, so we had to fight the Ponkas. Every tribe in Oklahoma fought the government. We had to fight a 5-man front, a 5-tribe front, and they taught the women their own language, so they couldn't tell where the warriors were. They spoke their own language. We're the only tribe in the country that has that distinction. And if the Sioux, if they had overrun, happened to overrun us, we wouldn't be anymore. I mean, there would be nobody here. And yet, they're the biggest snivers going. But our tribe broke up into 5 different tribes. But it's not in history. No, nobody writes about it in history. All you hear is Sioux and Geronimo and Joseph and people like this. 500 tribes. We haven't even talked to them yet. Or don't even have them writing about it in their real histories. You know, because they're still afraid. They're still afraid. Well, I must read part of the book. I'm talking too much here. Does anybody else have any questions? More questions?
About 100, but we only have an hour.
I have cards. We did have cards, and you call. You want to talk?
The name of their tribe again?
Ponca. P-O-N-C-A.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard of it.
Well, you've heard of the Omaha.
Oh, yeah.
Omaha call the Osage.
Osage.
They're all Ponca.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But by the time the Sioux come onto the plains, we were broken up.
Already.
And they wouldn't come help us fight them. But they feared us after a while because we had a military dog soldiers. They call them Washabes. If you see the book, that's the altar. That's the Washabe altar. They never were ever defeated in the battle. Nobody ever beat them. White, green, anyway. And they cut heads because they cut your head off. So you couldn't go to a happy hunting ground and barbecue up there.
Let's say, I think we're the, during World War II, there's a story I heard briefly about that, I don't know what tribe of Indians, they would speak in their language?
No.
Was that the one? It was impossible to decode.
Yeah. Exactly.
And this somehow won some great battle that turned the war around or something. Do you have any information on that? That was done in the language part.
Yeah, I know most of them guys. They were trying to help us get our nonprofit going. And they said they would come do talks for us about that. But they fought mainly. You know, they fought right alongside the Marines. They also had Comanche code talkers and Choctaw code talkers. The Cherokee, they figured them out too quick.
I'm Cherokee.
That big.
That was a household.
We'll talk later.
I'll be washing dishes all week.
If I had a car, I'd give me a car. You give me a car. We'll talk about these things. You know, that's the problem with me. I don't have anybody to talk to either. You know, that has any. You say something about it, we people, you know. can't have a decent conversation. You hate all white people. Jeez.
That'd be a hard place to start.
Huh? Yeah.
That'd be a hard place to start.
Yes.
Are people in your tribe now receptive to your spiritual leadership?
Oh,
they have to. There's definite happenings. That it's not good or bad, or, you know, like in the Bible. It's not biblical like that. It's just you don't mess with these things. You don't cuss me out behind my back, or you don't hurt my family. You don't do these things, because if I don't do it, whatever there is going to do it. See, there's a definite retaliation. Our people had it so good. They used it against the Sioux. You know, like throwing fireballs and like that. But it's not like that, but they had the definite medicine that they used on that. And it's true. And I've been trying to figure out a way. I've been trying to get a place so I can do a sweat. I mean, a real, honest to goodness sweat. Mm-hmm. And people get well. People bring their stuff and they get well. I don't do it, but what I got does. See? But and most of the Indians in Grass Valley and Auburn and up that way, they're afraid of me because they're afraid of their own Indianness. I'm for anybody that, you know, I'm not against anyone. I'll help anybody. But they call me names. They say I'm a bad medicine man. They say I'm a witch, brujo, and all that kind of stuff. But in the old days, it was an accepted thing. It wasn't a phenomenon. It was an accepted way of life, and it's still here. It's still here. And the reason why the older medicine. The reason older medicine men didn't, we'd go down and ask them, how come you didn't get them white people out of here? And they said, well, we can't do that. Because they're in your time. This is your time. You figure it out. See? Their medicine goes back, way back, but there were no other people but Indians. But with the immigrant people, I hate to say white people because it makes people mad. But with the white people and stuff around, blacks, Mexicans, they all come around. They see these things and they get afraid because of their religion. Because of their Catholic, because of Catholicism, because of the Methodist Church, because of that. And they say most of mine comes from the devil. And I don't. I don't care about the devil.
The herbs that that grow along the side of the highway, because of the exhaust fumes, mutated. So back from the highway, it still is mutated. Now, in the time before, he was talking about the herbs were very powerful, and they were different from now. So people, the Indian women, had plots like comfrey. That was her plot. She took care of that. It grew wild, but that was her place. So if another Indian woman wanted, or anyone else wanted comfrey, they wouldn't ask her first. They'd just go out and grab it, you know. and you give tobacco to the plants and thank them for the comfrey, for the herbs, for helping. So that's just one instance of the change. He's very saying he's not educated. He's almost a genius, in my opinion. I meant he comes from both sides of a medicine family. One is Thunder and Lightning, and the other one is Buffalo Clan. And the Buffalo Clan is the clan that sees that everybody has food, that everybody has clothing, that everybody has what they need, whether it's anything. So, like our foundation, we have helped child custody cases. We've helped women that have been beaten. We've helped children get well. We've had a man that wanted to find a wife. He did, by the way. And just all kinds of different things that go under what people need. And we not only have helped Indians, but we helped non-Indians too. One woman was cured of cancer in our lodge. But you walk this way, and it's truly, in a way, very difficult being walking in this world. I meant, it wasn't easy for them in the olden days either. They had floods and tornadoes. They were out in the middle of nowhere, most of them. But they dealt with it with their own medicine. That is what we have to do today, to watch our thinking so the negativity doesn't take over. You know, there's so much on TV and all around us. We've got to keep ourselves and know ourselves. So that's what this medicine does. You have to know yourself first, you know. We were on top of a mountain in a snowstorm, and, you know, I was scared to death. I'd not driven in snow an awful lot, and he says, "You can do it." "Oh, really?" You know. And then I prayed, and then I got calm, and I made it down the mountain. And I still, to this day, don't know how I did that. But it was, I have a very special place in my heart for children. And to see the children on the reservation, because the parents are drunk. The only thing in the refrigerator is alcohol. There's no food. They go and they entertain themselves because they're not supervised. One of the greatest things we did while we were there was we got donations of ham for Thanksgiving for these families. And so these children had something to eat that day. And it was, we did things like that. But the reservation is not an easy place to live. There's no jobs, there's no work. There are people on the res that want to change this. But you have to change the tribal council. And the vote, the one that biggest family is the one that controls the votes. It's the way it is. And if they're not actually trying to help the tribe, it's pretty bad. His family, they've had tribal chairman forever in your family, and It's when he talks about alcoholism and this stuff, you know, it was a way of life. He had no choice. But he did stop drinking, and he's been sober 25 years, 27 years now. And I really admire him for that. That is an easy thing to do when you've been given a drink when you're 5 years old. So this book has an awful lot about, on this chapter, it's about him going to Indian school. And this is actually the way they were taken from the mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and grandpas and grandmas. They were taken forcibly sometimes. You're going to go to school. An Indian school just wasn't down the block. It was in another town. So they were completely cut off from their families. And they had been gone to Indian school before, what, two generations? Two generations before you?
Three
generations before him. So they knew, you know, what was going to happen. So this is chapter three in this book. It's a very short chapter. But I wanted to read you a chapter because I wanted you to see the way he writes. He thinks in his language and translates it into English, which is a mighty thing to do. So here we are, chapter 3, standing there. The Indian school campus lies southeast of the city of Pawnee, Oklahoma. A small tree-lined creek runs out of the northeast and passes under a concrete bridge that's understood by all to be the entrance to the school property. The T-shaped school building in the first structure that comes into sight. It sits to the immediate left of the blacktop road and circles to the other buildings in a huge oval. The girls' building sits on the south side, the boys' on the north, with its front door facing east. The dining hall sits west of both of them. It's from out of this building the school got its name, Gravy U. The lawns were kept up at all times, and trees were scattered around to suit the entire scene of the campus. Sidewalks intersected within the bounds of those three main buildings. Behind the boys' building was an expanse of grass with separate areas for teeter-totters, a set of steel chain swings, a place for tetherball and heavy steel merry-go-round. A row of cedar trees sat to the north. Straight across the road sat a two-story wooden building with screened-in verandas on the north side. This building was where the school teachers lived. Down a gentle slope north of the building ran a small channel of water that eventually ran into the main stream of the Black Bear Creek, a mile straight west. South of the building was an empty space and then a row of garages that sat behind and across from the back of the mess hall. Behind and beyond those garages, open fields of tall yellow grass spread westward until they ran into the tree line that was part of the vast area of the Black Bear Creek. I knew I didn't want to be there. No words could describe the hurt I felt. Even now, when I remember that day, I flinch. I still feel the emptiness of being away from all I'd known and knowing I could never go back from then on. This chain of events broke the strings that once held my life together. The places I knew before I left would be strange when I would go there again. I'd never see Grandpa again like I knew him before, nor would I ever walk among the trees to the east timber again. It all changed when the bus took us away. There will never be an apology that can make it right. No reward will ever be enough to placate the hurt that was deliberately inflicted on us children of 5 and 6. It was at this supposed place of learning I was to hear for the first time that threatening expression I've grown so tired of hearing in my life among white people. It was an expression I still don't understand. It was that what was happening to me was for my own good. And it wasn't just me the tree spoke to that hot September afternoon. Each of us children couldn't help but hear the whirring of the locusts. Because of the new place we were at, it was like hearing them for the first time and being aware of them. It was as if I had stepped off into someone else's afternoon. We were each alone and away from that part of our lives where locusts belonged. It was a sad beginning of moments that would eventually turn into the killing kind of memories. It was that first step of a third generation down a path into a world that had failed to assimilate the first two or change their color to white. That evening of my first day, I remember being drawn toward the playground. The other children had all gone into the mess hall for supper. Although it had been a miserable day for me, an unexplainable good feeling came over me. I saw that interval of finding myself alone as one of beauty. Instead of wanting to eat, I gave in to the whir of the locusts that called me from the huge trees standing beyond the playground area. I walked to the merry-go-round and stood leaning against it. I watched the shadow of the tallest tree move across the lawn toward the end of the boys' building. As I was watching, an entire thought of the day before came to me with the shock of vivid recall. It had been the last day of the Ponca powwow, and I was walking slowly along an old road just south of the camping area. The smell of wood smoke and cooking meat filled the air. I heard the bells of the dancers ringing faintly through the trees to the northeast. I knew they were making their way to the dance grounds. Sunlight was still shining from above through the trees around me, and there was a slight chill in the air. I was walking slowly down toward the river. When I got to the bank, I walked upriver a ways to where a point of land extends out into the water. The raging of the river down below hit the bank and caused the smell of mud to rise up to where I walked. I heard the lapping movement of water, and then I stopped. From there I looked across the wide river. The western bank and the jagged tree line above it was one of long black shadow that extended in both directions as far as my eyes could see. Above that line of shadow, wisps of cloud shone a bright pink and a brilliant white. The evening sun hung in the lower sky, a giant orange orb. I wanted to freeze that sight in my mind because I knew a yet distant day would come when I would be able to describe what I felt as I stood there. The dark raging river, the feel of shadow, and the knowing that nighthawks were out hunting made me feel alive. The drumming for the grand entry was beginning. I heard it through the trees, muffled because of the distance, but I could hear it. I would always hear it, and because I could, I knew my people, no matter what I ever did, were out there dancing. As I stood by the merry-go-round, I remember trying to bring back the memory of the day and the happiness I felt. The happiness was equal to the vividness of the memory I just experienced, but I still felt a sudden great loneliness overtake me. It was as if an invisible curtain had suddenly dropped and enclosed the playground within that moment. The air became cooler, and an ache came into my heart, an ache so bad I couldn't cry the way I wanted to. When I was beginning to question what was happening to me, I caught sight of something moving across the road toward the west. When I turned that way and gave my full attention to it, I saw a woman dressed in a two-piece calico dress that the older Indian women used to wear. She was standing still. Her left arm extended downward. Her hand rested on top of the head of a huge black hound sitting on his haunches next to her. It looked directly at me, eyes yellow, the pupils white, slit like those of a cat. There was night in her eyes. I saw in the shadows of her brows the glitter of stars. I felt the sensation of waking right after a dream. She smiled at me and motioned me to come to her. I would have, except for the fear I felt. I wanted to run away and cry out in pain that burned my senses. Within that thought, I looked away, and for no reason, I began to laugh. When I looked back to where the woman had been, I saw her running and leaping across the tall grass in the field away from me toward the west. Step by step, she was gradually taking the shape of a giant owl. Soon she was able to take that one clumsy leap that launched her in flight. The strip of the calico cloth that had been the top half of her dress a few moments before was now flapping and waving behind her from the turbulence of her wings. Out of those few moments, from that day forward, she would be with me. In my dreams to haunt me, she would haunt my days with sighs and sounds of a green field on a hot summer's day where there would be gunfire, screaming horses, and swirling dust. I gained a sense of knowledge that would always be there for me when people let me down. I began to view the world from that position of thought, a part of it yet separate from its function. I knew that what I experienced in that impersonal atmosphere of the school was a personal conflict, and how I fought and how I came away from it would determine my bargaining position between being totally assimilated and Indian. And I would be Indian. I would fight. I would come to know the terms of engagement within those halls of the Indian school like a dog would. I would come to know that the measurement of learning was how much I was beaten down and how many times I got up. And that is really amazing. You want to tell us about that chapter, honey? Is it time? Oh,
quarter to nine.
You can answer.
I wrote that chapter because purpose of it would be all through the book after the other characters in it, and we believed in those kind of things because we heard them all our lives. And there were other things that baby syndrome. It was a person like an elephant with an elephant nose that sucked their breath. Birds did the other things. It wasn't the people themselves that died. They were attacked by these things that flew in the air or come up on the ground. They were made to die by their own will. But they to block that they had. That's why they use eagle feathers. Eagle feathers are prayer directly up, straight up. They put them on guns. They use silver bullets. If they know one's coming, and they've got guys that knew they were coming. And a whole way of life. It ended when we go talk to the old medicine men and ask them why they didn't do anything anymore like they did in the past, and they said, well, that's not up to us anymore. It's your world. That's what I said that a while ago. This is your world. You go out there and find out the ways to deal with it, because these people are here now no matter what. And I say that even if they took it over, they're going to get hurt. They're going to have more casualties than anything else. But if we teach them, they can teach other people and so on and so on. And nobody would agree with me. So I've had that trouble all my life. And wanting to share these things, because if we don't, we're just going to have the same argument every time we meet. Who's in charge? I'm the leader. It don't have to be that way. But it is. And those, these are things that I believe we're making inroads in, into it. I am. I'm trying. But people are more afraid of me than they are of the benefits that can come out of it. I'm not saying I'm going to heal everybody. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's a way that can help most of the little, the smaller things. When we had our sweat in Auburn, we had Barbara Boxer and Feinstein. Come up for a sweat. Mm-hmm. They didn't talk about nothing. They just wanted to sweat. They come in and they sweat and they go. And then one time we had the Monsignor down there. He come up. And we told him, you're going to take that bad big old cross. I told you, better take that off. It's going to burn you. He that's all right. Thank God. Jesus. The devil isn't here. He got in there. Second round, man. It really got hot that second round. He was in the, they call it the honor seat, straight back. I'll show you. He opened that door. He was getting over that thing. I think it was stuck to his chest. trying to help him. I couldn't help but laugh. He was. But it was interesting. We all laughed at him anyway.
Well, some people say they want to be healed, and when it comes right down to it, they don't.
They want to go in there their way.
They want it, yes. And
those ways are the way it is, how it's been done for. You know, they found these scientists in Texas were looking around this bog. It was a bog, and they found holes all around. I knew some of them were teepee, 16 holes, teepee. In those days, they must have had. That's when they had four doors. They've got one door now, but they had eight doors on them, 16 poles. Sweat Lodge, they found a perfect circle, and it was. They called this guy him Comanche, fire maker, rainmaker. And he went down there and told them what it was. He said, "That's a Sweat Lodge." He built a sweat lodge right over it. And they estimated it's 42,000 years old. So figure it out. It hasn't changed a bit since then. So evidently it works. I mean, no one took it elsewhere. No one added to it.
Well, tell them a little bit about the sweat lodge. You know, about the umbilical cord and the womb. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, how many of you been in a sweat lodge? Well, there's a pit dug out, and you build a new moon.
That's
in the shape of a new moon. Mm-hmm. Your fire pit comes down to level. Built like that, so the guy that's bringing in the rocks has a hard time. It's not supposed to be easy. And they bring in the rock, and in front of the lodge is a buffalo skull. And people have told me I've got once an altar, but the people say it's devil worship and stuff. Kind of like a goat head, goat skull. But it's not. All that skull means is that the front is for the now, future, now. Back of it's for what happened a long time ago. And you put your horns are where you put your pipes. If you bring a pipe, you honor the pipe. They don't even do that anymore. But there's a little, but they have a, into the middle of the lodge, there's the fire pit, and that's the moon. Moon of the earth, Mother Earth. And you built rocks from the umbilical cord all the way to the fire. Little rocks out of the umbilical cord.
You bury them.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the women sit on that side. Some sweat leaders are just taught to do men. Mm-hmm. Some men just do women. I do both. I do the transsexual.
Gender, honey, both genders. Yeah. And cedars put in between them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like saying that our community is our wealth.
Mm-hmm.
The integrity of the tribe has to be a survival system.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wonder about is how did dependence on the white man's money affect the integrity that was the survival of the tribal system?
It broke the system apart. It broke the system apart. The main one that broke it apart in this day and age was the relocation program. They call it the relocation program. And the guy I forgot his name, Freeman or something, they hired him. He's the one that set up the Japanese camps in World War II. And they promised our people, the family home and the white picket fence and the flowers and all that kind of good stuff. But what it was they dropped us all off into the barrios and the ghettos and the worst places, the gang turf. And they put us off in gang turf in Denver. A lot of the guys like Dennis Banks and Russell Means, they put them in black communities. In Oakland, Oakland and Vallejo. The money that they made before they went on this program was from what do you call that kind of work where you follow the harvest.
Migratory
work. Mm-hmm. And you made enough to come back, get your kids some clothes, and you get them some food, and maybe buy a car, like that. But the rest of what's left, after everything you've done, everything good, you drink it. You drink it up. Well, in Denver, they taught them how to do, they taught them trades like sandblasting, and they were getting paid 10, 15 bucks an hour. Man, that's a lot of money to an Indian. And they were buying furniture and sheets and silk sheets and pillows and a good steak, steaks and icebox and all that kind of shrimp. Yeah, you never heard of shrimp, but that shrimp and icebox. And with the rest of it, they got drunk. But it was a lot of money, heck of a lot more money than they ever had. And that's what broke the families up. And when they started on that alcohol, they forgot the damn going to work. And we were on the streets. I had to take care of my little brother. And I learned how to steal it, because I had to keep him fed. I'm glad he was bigger, because then I didn't have to get him diapers. But that's how it broke it. The guys would, and they would go and get killed. They'd get bar fights and all that kind of stuff. Car wrecks. And they had no families then. And that's not right about now. It It did what they wanted it to do. They broke the family system in two. Nobody wanted the kids back home, so they put it back in the Indian schools. The boarding schools became homes. And that's where the that's the main that's the problem that we're trying to recover from, because instead of acting like Indians, we're acting like blacks, Mexicans, white people. We're acting like that instead of grasping on to our roots or hanging on to what the hell we got. And there's very few practices. The five civilized tribes, they have a stomp dance, which is their spiritual dance. They still have that. It's powerful, but they won't go. They don't have anybody yet that can take that, what comes out of that, and go do something with it. See, it's there. There's nothing in the world stopping them from doing it. Only they don't know how to do it. See. We have it at home. We have our medicine there. I'm the only one that can do it. Without me, they can't do it. And in the other sense, like peyote, as the oldest, on my father's side, which was a peyote side, they had I inherited the bundle. I don't even believe in that stuff. Because peyote is not. If I want to choose a drug, I want to choose my own drug. In other words, and that's what it is. And I also on my traditional side, I have a pipe that I found on a river. It's my pipe.
Well, tell me how you found it.
I believe that it's all there. It's all together. Everything that we ever had, but we have broken. But because of the broken families, we have no brother help. We have no cousin help. No sister help. Where all my sisters fail me, I don't have no cousins to take it up. See what I'm talking about? We can even feed each other, but we don't have that kind of help to get us up, and we might even take over the world. If we get up and do it.
Did the Indian school break that strength up, or was that part of it?
Well, the Indian school, was where you had access to girlfriends. you had that, but see, you never got to finish that. I was telling her. I never got to have the women that I loved when we were growing up. I said, you had your boyfriends and you had your... And it's not a resentful thing. I'm telling a fact, you know. You had a choice in all this. Plus, alcohol decided everything we did. By the time we got out of school, 2, 3 years after we got out of school, they're all dead. The girls, the women, the ones that I love are dead. I can't have them. I resent that. See, that's one thing I resent about this life. That's what I can survive, but not that. I didn't get to have. We may not have made it, but I didn't never get that chance. And then Vietnam came up. Vietnam came right. All of us boys at Fort Sill, every to a man, that were old enough to go into service when it went to Vietnam. But that's where we survived in the best in war. That's what we were good at. That was our thing. But like I told her too, I said, when I come back and try to find love, try to find whatever it takes to get married and things like that, I didn't have it. I left my heart in Bong Song. The village over there that we fought over constantly. And in a way, I died there. That was not the kind of death where you lay down and die, but you appear something, just you die, you know, because you lost, we lost so many men there. I left my wings there, my jump wings, and I didn't have nothing left when I got back here. I still have that problem. This is what we need the medicine for. See, this is what we need our medicine for. This is why we need a lodge of our own, where you can say, "Well, I've got a heartache," not some lie about your wife leaving you or something like that, you know. But really, I don't know about real honesty. I don't know if you're by real honesty. But you can say, "Well, I got a heartache that needs to be fixed." Okay, let's fix it. That's what I'm talking about. These are the things that keep most people down anyway. Not only Indians, but anybody that's ever lived has had that love problem. That wasn't there, love you lost, love you couldn't hang on to, love you shot somebody over, love you fought over, you know, stuff like that. And it never got resolved, but you still have to go on living. These are things that give you the damn cancer. These are things that give you all these diseases we get later on. Because it festers, your mind festers, and man, you're going to pop out with something. And that's what I believe anyway. You know, and I believe those things can be fixed. I believe, because they have something for all of that. All of the things.
Everything.
Comprehensive medical plan.
It's time.
The Funka healthcare.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's time, honey.
We're if there's any more questions, I'm glad you all come, and I hope we said something worthwhile, and I'll stick with you and give you bad dreams.
We also have some cassette tapes, not cassette, CD tapes, and he has some books of the CD tape. Oh, yeah. Give me a CD tape.
Yeah, they, Victoria has some CDs, which are is it CT reading the?
Yeah, it's the book on, you have to put it in the computer.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they're selling that to benefit their foundation. And so those of you who've been to these talks before know that we have a donation bowl over on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute to it, because we share that to support the work of our speaker, in this case the foundation that he's established, as well as to maintain this space. So thank you all for coming tonight, and I look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you.